Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. For years, fitness experts have been recommending weight training as a part of any exercise regimen, whether you'd like Schwarzenegger muscles or just want to counteract the natural muscle loss due to aging. But for those who hate lifting weights, there's some good news. Lowering them may be even more important. It's a technique called negative weight training, and with us from Orlando to explain its positive effects is Ellington Darden, fitness expert and author of the book, The Body Fat Breakthrough, about tapping the power of negative weight training. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, Ann.
First of all, tell us what you mean by negative weight training.
Picking up a weight, and, for example, doing a barbell curl, when you lift the weight, the muscle contracts in a way that's called concentric muscle action. When you lower a weight, you have to fight against gravitational forces, and the muscle also works against an action which is called eccentric muscle action. So you've got a simplified process that was done by a man named Arthur Jones in the 1970s, which you mentioned earlier with the Nautilus equipment. He said, concentric and eccentric, it's hard to get the hang of which is what. So he shortened it to positive and negative work. When you lift the weight up, you're performing positive work. And when you lower it, it's negative work. And he found through research in the 1970s that the negative, the lowering part of the exercise, is the most beneficial as far as stimulating growth or muscular size and strength. So that's what the book is about, how to apply this technique from Arthur Jones and Nautilus in sort of a new, exciting way to precipitate the loss of body fat.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Ellington Darden. He's a fitness expert and author of the book, The Body Fat Breakthrough. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what particular benefits does negative weight training offer? How is it different from positive?
Well, it makes a deeper inroad. It takes the chemistry involved in the fatiguing of a muscle to a new level. It's more thorough, and this fatiguing process is deeper, and it stimulates more of six different hormones in the body, which facilitate the building of muscle and the loss of fat. So it's complicated, and it's not easy to understand, but if you get the feel of it, boy, you can sure see it happening in your body, the loss of fat and the building of muscle at the same time.
Technique is critical. When you see people at the gym or wherever lifting weights, sometimes they're just going up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down, and it looks macho, but it's not what you're talking about.
No, this is a very slow, deliberate process of taking about 20 seconds to lower a weight and another 20 seconds to lift it and a final 20 seconds to lower it. So if you can imagine just doing a push-up, starting at the top of a push-up and going down in 20 seconds, and turning it around and going up in 20 seconds and then down in 20 seconds. You've got twice as much lowering, twice as much negative as you do the positive or the raising. Mm-hmm. And that's the beneficial effect of this type of exercise. Boy, it stimulates the muscles to grow. And if you cut back on your calories, it stimulates more fat loss.
Right, because the muscle, when you're growing muscle, you're eliminating fat?
No, when you're growing muscle, your body requires calories.
Okay.
Quite a bit. And if you are deleting or reducing your dietary calories, it has to draw the source of energy. energy or calories from your body fat. And it does this very productively once you get the hang and once your body gets into this modality of fat loss and muscle building at the same time.
Is it easy to do negative training incorrectly?
It sure is. It's easy to do just about anything in life that's meaningful incorrectly, you know. Mm-hmm. So you got to do it properly to get the best results. And that's why I spend about half of the book telling people and showing them what proper negative training is. It goes back to slow, smooth movement, to looking for ways to make exercise harder, not easier. And like you commented, Ann, so many people, they want to look for easier ways to exercise. Well, my book is about harder ways to exercise.
Does it matter how much weight you're using?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to get the resistance on a barbell or a machine or even your body weight. It has to be done. You have to have the correct amount of resistance, and that takes a couple of practice tries to get it, usually. So, again, I go into detail on how to do this properly. So,
resistance changes over time, so it's something that's changing. Not necessarily.
What do you mean it changes?
Well, I mean, maybe the resistance I'm looking for is a 10-pound barbell, but maybe down the road I'm up to a 15-pound barbell, or not necessarily?
Well, that could be the case. It just depends on what happens during the aging process as you get older. Now, in one chapter in my book, I point out that most people lose from the ages of 20 to 50 years. They lose about a half a pound of muscle a year through what's called disuse atrophy. You know, they're not as active. They don't do as much resistance on whatever type of lifting and lowering they do.
Mm-hmm.
So they start losing muscle. And at the same time, they're gaining fat. So this leads to the dangerous situation which we have in the United States of obesity, you know, of people who are overfat and out of shape.
Most people think that cardiovascular work is where it's at, though.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate. That's a part of the answer, but most of the answer, at least in my opinion, centers around keeping your muscle strong and rebuilding the muscle that you've lost as you've gotten older, which speeds up your metabolic rate, which causes your body to burn more calories, and which then, after you get rid of the excessive fat, it allows you to use your cardiovascular system, which are, you know, there's nothing more than working your muscles in an endurance fashion, but doing that in a way that provides both strength and cardiovascular endurance at the same time.
The training regimen in your book, The Body Fat Breakthrough, requires only one 20-minute weight training workout a week. And you said your book's about how to do it harder. Is that really enough?
Well, most people, if you're pretty strong, yeah, one time a week is more than enough. Most people probably would be better off starting with twice a week. And after 6 weeks, cutting it down to once a week or perhaps three times in 2 weeks. So I show people how to do that. But eventually, yeah, once a week, you know, now that you're twice as strong, once a week is absolutely all most people can stand done in this negative accentuated fashion.
So
to do more is a mistake.
Okay, you're giving your muscles a rest.
Yeah, your muscles grow when you're resting. They don't grow when you're exercising. They're only, you know, they're stimulated to grow through exercise. Then you got to back off, rest, relax, sleep, and allow this to occur.
A lot of people think that a high-protein diet is really pretty important for building muscle, but the diet you recommend is mostly carbohydrates. What's the difference? Why is that?
Well, if you analyze a pound of muscle, you see that about 72% of muscle, not protein, it's water. So I've got a whole chapter in my book on putting more water into your system, superhydrating it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not much protein in muscle. What your body needs for growth is energy, and your body prefers carbohydrates as the most efficient source of energy. So, yeah, 50% of my diet in this book is made up of breads and cereals and fruits and vegetables, you know, your carbohydrate-rich foods.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the numbers on the scale, should we expect them to plummet, or might we actually gain weight when we lift weights? How does that look?
Yeah, if you don't, if you continue to eat the same number of calories you've been consuming, then you should be adding body weight because your body is becoming larger and stronger from the muscle that you're creating. But on the other hand, if you are reducing your calories, trying to lose fat, then most people have a lot more fat to lose than they have muscle to build. So the end result is that your body weight goes down even though your muscle mass goes up. And you can see the pictures in the book that show this dramatically, the before and after pictures.
Tell us what happens to our muscles as we age and how this technique helps overcome some of that.
Well, that's what I was talking about earlier about disuse atrophy. If you don't use a muscle, and most people cut way back on their physical activity once they get in their 20s and 30s, and if you do that, your muscles lose fluid, and in this fluid is a part of the chemistry that causes the size and the shape of the muscle itself. So you gradually lose muscle size and strength. But the average American hardly notices that because they're gaining fat at the same time as they go through their 30s and 40s. So unfortunately, this creeping obesity covers up the disuse atrophy.
Well, so let's say I'm a 50-year-old and I haven't done a lot of exercise in the last 10 or 15 years, but I want to get back in shape. Can this kind of a technique help me, or is it too late?
No, it's the ideal form of exercise for people in their 50s and 60s and even 70s. So it's something you can get the hang of. It's slow, smooth, it's safe, and all you got to do is just follow the illustrated photographs and the details in the book, and it doesn't take long. You know, we're talking about 20 minutes a session.
Mm-hmm.
And twice a week, and then eventually once a week, and then drink more water and follow the dietary guidelines in here, and you're going to be surprised at the results you get.
Okay, well, I'm filling up my cup right now. Ellington Darden, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann. Bye now.
Ellington Darden, he's a fitness expert and author of the book, The Body Fat Breakthrough. Wellness Wednesday continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. If your dishwasher's acting up or your car is on the fritz, you can consult the owner's manual for advice and maybe even a diagnosis. But for the intricate data processing system atop our shoulders, also known as the brain, troubleshooting can get a whole lot more complex, especially as we learn more every day about what causes pain, why we're depressed, and what happens when we sleep. Joining us now is the author of an updated edition of The Owner's Manual for the Brain, The Ultimate Guide to Peak Mental Performance at All Ages. He is also research director at the Center for Applied Cognitive Studies in Charlotte, North Carolina. Dr. Pierce Howard, welcome to the show.
A pleasure to be with you, Ann.
This is the fourth edition of the book, The Owner's Manual for the Brain. What prompted you to edit the old one? What changed?
Well, the original plan was to come out with a new edition about every 5 or 6 years. The logic behind that is that the 90s were the decade of the brain, as it was officially charged nationally. And what has happened is that there are new branches in the tree of brain research that are constantly poking out from the trunk. Back in the 90s, there was no such thing as the neuroscience of music or the neuroscience of math or the neuroscience of marketing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so what has happened is you put out one edition, and before you know it, you've got these other shoots that stick out from the trunk that need to be recognized. So that's really the logic behind it.
You've removed a lot of information about mental disorders. Why is that?
The reason is that discoveries are so rapid, both in terms of new drugs, new treatments, new protocols, new understanding about causes, the changes are so frequent that it actually becomes dangerous to put it in print. It needs to be put in something that's more dynamic, such as the Internet. And the National Institutes of Mental Health are doing such a good job keeping bountiful information on every imaginable brain disease, injury, or disorder that it was appearing to be irresponsible to continue to try to cover the state of the art in a book that was going to be fixed for the next 5 or 6 years. So that's the logic behind it.
You know, the Owner's Manual for the Brain is sort of an overwhelming concept to begin with. Why did you think it was necessary to write a book and produce a manual like this in the first place?
Well, two things. Number one is there is an awful lot of research out there, and the general public does not have access to it, particularly in an accessible, readable, consolidated format. Research is tough to read. When you go to the learned journals and et cetera, the average person, when they read about melatonin and 6 milligrams of this and 3 of that, mm-hmm. and all of that, their eyes glaze over. And so what, in fact, and the original title of the book was So What? and my wife loved it, but my publisher did not. And the publisher said, it's a little bit too flip. And what I meant by that title, though, was here's all this brain research. Well, so what? You know, so what? You found this out, you found that out. And so what the book purports to do is to take each piece of brain research finding that has daily application and explain what those applications are. So, for example, with the discovery that there's a neurotransmitter called melatonin, the so-called sleep neurotransmitter, well, that's good to know, but what difference does it make? So what? So one of the applications for that piece of knowledge is to understand that melatonin is produced from consuming dairy products. And so the old advice to have a warm glass of milk before retiring in the evening was actually wise advice. And in fact, warm milk is better than cold milk because it metabolizes more quickly and will help you get to sleep more quickly. So that that was one reason, because there is so much research out there that was not accessible to the person on the street, that I felt some responsibility for doing that.
I remember even 4.5 years ago when I would do a show on neuroplasticity, the idea that the brain could change and we could change our brain. That was something that most of us grew up thinking was impossible.
That's right. In fact, the first edition of the book did not include anything about neuroplasticity. It was once a brain cell was gone, it was gone forever.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, findings in the latter part of the 90s began to challenge that notion. But even then, the claims that are being made for neuroplasticity today, while they make a lot of recovery seem more hopeful now than it was 20 years ago, there are many claims for the ability to change that I'm afraid are rather grandiose and have the effect of making people guilty for not being able to change more quickly.
Hmm.
Major changes in brain structure require prodigious effort. They may require surgery, they may require drugs, they may require intensive regimens that you have to stick to. It is not something to be taken lightly.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Wellness Wednesday, and my guest is the author of The Owner's Manual for the Brain, The Ultimate Guide to Peak Mental Performance at All Ages. It's a big, fat book, and his name is Dr. Pierce Howard. He is Research Director at the Center for Applied Cognitive Studies in Charlotte, North Carolina. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Pierce Howard, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You've included, as I mentioned, you know, a host of new sections and chapters, one of which is on drugs. And has the thinking really changed there? Is the legalization of marijuana likely to change attitudes even more?
Yeah, that's a really tough issue. Legalization of marijuana, I heard an interesting discussion on NPR earlier this week about legalization is one thing, legalization of smoking is another. One of the informed attitudes, in my opinion, is the legalization of marijuana in medical form to be consumed, as a powder, as a substance, or whatnot. But for recreational uses, that is another matter.
Mm-hmm.
There is still a raging debate about the suitability of legalization for recreational purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So the other issue of in terms of drugs, one of the really difficult areas today has to do with the relationship of the pharmaceutical companies, the academic journals, and the hospitals. There is a vicious circle that Elliot Valenstein, University of Michigan, has written about, in which the pharmaceutical company pays the doctor to do the testing for the drugs, a very nice fee. They also pay to support the academic journals that publish the results of the studies. And as a consequence, there has been a tendency for journals to suppress findings that are adverse to the supporting pharmaceutical company, and there has been a tendency for doctors to bend the rules so that they continue to get the grants from the pharmaceutical companies that are supporting them. All of this is described in disturbing detail in Valenstein's book and summarized in my book. But it is an area in which we need vigilance and whistleblowing or whatever, particularly in the academic journals that publish the results of controlled studies. And we need vigilance in the hospitals as well. In fact, it's not just limited to drugs. There is ample evidence that the whole research establishment in the U.S. is in need of greater oversight, but particularly in the area of drug trials.
The emphasis on drugs in how we cure or how we treat disease has changed over time. It's almost paramount now, although I've had plenty of shows with people who want to talk more about diet, want to talk more about exercise, and start to bring that back into the fore of the conversation.
Yes. In fact, exercise and diet are probably two of the best forms of self-medication that we know about, and also cheaper with fewer negative side effects. So, to me, one of the primary functions of pharmaceuticals is to enable changes in behavior. So, for example, when we have attention deficit disorder, the goal is to teach the individual, whether it's a child or an adult, the goal is for the individual to learn new habits. This is neuroplasticity, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're back to the same subject. Mm-hmm. We're trying to hopefully learn new behaviors. The reason for taking Ritalin is to enable, to facilitate the learning of that new behavior. It's easier to learn the new behaviors while on Ritalin. And so the goal is to, at some point, once the new behavior is established, to get off the Ritalin. But all too often, the Ritalin is prescribed, and there is no allowance for getting the new behavioral patterns learned and mastered. So it's drugs only, as opposed to drugs plus behavioral therapy.
That's part of our system in which insurance covers the drugs, but not the behavior modification.
Bingo. And that leads us back to that vicious triangle that we were talking about earlier.
Jane in East Liverpool, you're on the air with Dr. Pierce Howard. Hi, Jane.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good, good. I went through a crisis, medical crisis, and one result was I had a sepsis, pretty serious septic shock. And I feel since that time I've really lost a lot of function of my brain. And I'm just wondering if the doctor could comment on that and provide resources I might look into.
Well, I really wish I could. I am not a medical doctor and don't pretend to be. And what the primary resource is that I would recommend in terms of an online resource is the National Institutes of Mental Health and the Center for Stroke and Disorders, and there's excellent information there. You know, other than that, I go back to what Ann was saying earlier, and that is that we are such Jane, we're such a complex system. And the basics that our system requires, which include adequate sleep, appropriate diet, appropriate exercise, having an active lifestyle rather than a sedentary lifestyle, those are like the basics, getting back to the basics that help keep our system in operating function. And there is all too often, and I'm not saying, Jane, this is for you by any means, there's all too often, and I think of friends and associates who are this way, there's all too often a tendency to want a pill or a surgical procedure to be able to fix something that lifestyle may very well be able to address. You know, one of the hardest things for me is exercise. I try my darndest to do a 2-mile brisk walk 5 times a week, and it is it is it's a struggle. I mean, it's almost harder to get my exercise in than to eat right, because I'm out and about a lot, and lots of restaurants and lots of travel. But the world is a seducer with all kinds of good ways not to exercise and not to eat right. So I don't know, Jane, how. I can't address the sepsis issue directly, not being a medical doctor, but I will say this, that throughout the process of looking for solutions and alternatives, that it would certainly make sense to try to commit to supporting that search for the appropriate treatment or whatever, to support that by making the strongest effort to engage in an optimal lifestyle. One element, by the way, that I didn't mention, I mentioned sleep, exercise, diet, and an active lifestyle. Two other ones that research is pointing to, or actually three other ones that research is pointing to as that need to be part of those basics. One is treating caffeine as a drug.
Hmm.
That there is a dosage associated with caffeine. The dosage is 1 milligram of caffeine per pound of body weight, approximately. And that translates, for example, to one strong cup of coffee for a 100-pound person. And it takes about 6 to 7 hours to metabolize, depending on individual body size and exercise patterns and that sort of thing. So my recommendation is like, one dose of caffeine in the morning and one in mid-afternoon, and that's it. And I have suggested that to a lot of people with reported very, very fine results. But it's for some people live under the illusion that the more caffeine, the more alert they're going to be. And the research says over and over again that that's an illusion, that we think we're more alert when in fact we're just jittery.
Okay. Not to be confused.
Yeah.
Jane, thanks a lot for that call. Dr. Pierce Howard, thank you so much for your conversation today. We really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate your calling.
Dr. Pierce Howard, he's research director at the Center for Applied Cognitive Studies in Charlotte, North Carolina, and he has also just published the fourth edition of his book, The Owner's Manual for the Brain, The Ultimate Guide to Peak Mental Performance at All Ages. Wellness Wednesday will continue. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The mumps outbreak that started 3 months ago at Ohio State has now infected more than 200 people. I think it was 212 yesterday. It may be more by today. And it doesn't show any signs of slowing. For the last 50 years, a mumps vaccine has been routinely given to American kids, but it's not 100% effective to begin with. And in fact, several of those infected in this bout had received the vaccine years ago. While most people recover fully from it, mumps can cause serious complications, and health officials are not taking this outbreak lightly. Here to tell us more is Columbus Health Commissioner Dr. Teresa Long and also Dr. Dennis Cunningham. He's an epidemiologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, good afternoon. Good morning. That's how busy we are.
Not yet. Not yet.
Good morning.
Soon.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Long, should we be worried? Will the outbreak just continue spreading? And a 2006 outbreak in the Midwest infected more than 6,000 people or what? How does it work?
So we actually are potentially early on in this outbreak here in Columbus. We actually have both an outbreak connected to Ohio State University and many others who are linked to that, but also a community outbreak. So we do now have, as of yesterday late afternoon, we announced 224 cases here in the Columbus, Franklin County, and Delaware County, all connected in one community outbreak, with 139 cases connected to the Ohio State University outbreak.
So fewer and fewer associated with OSU.
Starting to see more, of course, an uptick in the community related, which is, again, not surprising. Mm-hmm. So, again, where are we? A prediction? I'm not big into predicting. I don't think we're done yet. We're still seeing a good number of cases being reported every day. So we are actively investigating and, of course, trying to link them and prevent the further spread of this infection.
Dr. Cunningham, is this, when we say it's early in the outbreak, how do we know it's early in an outbreak? How do you define that?
Part of epidemiology is looking what's happened in similar situations and looking at other experiences at other college campuses in the United States. It frequently starts in the spring and it's still there in the fall when school comes back. So again, I can't give you a firm and hard prediction, but I would be very pleasantly surprised if this was gone before the fall.
Because it's not weather-related. Often we think of flu season as during the fall and winter and late spring, but this doesn't have a season.
And it's, well, actually there is. Okay. And that's what Dr. Okay. Cunningham was referring to, okay. is there actually is a bit of seasonality. I can't say it's weather-related,
okay.
but clearly there is both a spring and a fall okay. uptick
Absolutely.
in this infection.
If you have a question or comment about the mumps, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Are we seeing a lot of complications with these 224 cases? What are some typical ones?
So first of all, the disease often starts similar to people having a flu or a viral illness, aches and pains, fever, feeling bad. And then the classic symptom, Anne, is actually this swelling of the, call it the cheeks, the lower cheeks. It's really the salivary glands or parotiditis.
Would that be just below the jawline or is it?
It can be actually right at the jaw or okay. right below. And okay. actually, we were just chatting about this. And in fact, classic is jaw pain. And so it is something that we look for.
Check your jaws.
Though there's a good number of people who actually never have symptoms. And so that's part of the complication of this illness is that there's both a very long incubation period and there are a group of people who do not show symptoms and they're shedding, of course, this virus, exposing others. So
they're carriers.
Yes, they are. They have infection, but no symptoms. And that's about 30% of people infected with mumps don't have symptoms.
And when we say no symptoms, we mean the kind of classic symptoms that you're able to say, oh, I have the mumps. They may not feel well.
They may have nothing. They may feel
fine. Oh, absolutely not. Okay.
But you're right. Everything, there's a spectrum. Some people can be mild, some are on the more severe side, but many will have nothing to tell you. And that's what makes controlling an outbreak like this so challenging. You know, flu, it comes, it's pretty fast after you're exposed to it and you know it. Mumps, it can take anywhere from 12 to 25 days after you're exposed to have symptoms.
Just to have symptoms, and then you're contagious for how long?
Well, generally after the symptoms arise, then we ask people to stay home from work, from school for at least 5 days. So then the other question, Anne, that you just posed was, so then what? Are there more serious problems that can occur? And right. clearly we've seen some very sick students and community members. Some have been hospitalized. But I also think people are paying attention to the more serious consequences that can occur. We can have meningitis, which, of course, is an infection that really surrounds the brain. We have not seen that here in Columbus and Franklin County and Central Ohio, thank goodness. Mm-hmm. But what we have seen are two of, I shouldn't say two, the reproductive organs, both male and female, can become inflamed. And so we have indeed seen 7 cases of males who have orchitis, the inflammation of the testicles, and one woman who has the inflammation of her ovaries. And then we've had one case that really is concerning as well, which is new unexplained onset of deafness. And so again, that too is very concerning.
And you have seen that?
Right here in Columbus and Franklin County. Yes.
Leslie in Canal Winchester, you're on the air with Dr. Teresa Long, Columbus Health Commissioner, and also Dr. Dennis Cunningham, an epidemiologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm a 61-year-old. I have no idea what my shot record was. My mother and father are both deceased. And I wonder, should I get a booster shot? And then I also have two sons who got their booster shot when they were in sixth grade in 92 and 94. And I wonder if they're in the population where they ought to get the shot. Both of them have young children who were too young for the shot. Before 18 months. And so I'm just wondering who should get the shot.
Well, even Leslie, a lot of people in Leslie's age group did get a shot, but one, that's pre-booster era, right? So what? Even with Leslie doesn't know if she's had any, a lot of people know they have had one. Should they get the booster?
Part of the problem when people say they got one shot, it used to be that the measles, the mumps, and the rubella were all separate injections.
Right.
Now we have them combined. So one of the questions is we're not always sure whether or not they actually did have one measles dose in the past. In the setting of an outbreak, every adult needs at least one dose of MMR. If people are not sure if they have one dose, it's probably better to err on the side of caution and make sure you have at least one dose that you have documented.
And if you've had mumps in the past,
you can still come down with mumps. Mumps is one of these interesting viral diseases. You don't get lifelong protection like you do for measles. And that is one of the risk factors. So if people really don't know if they had this, if they had it as a child many, many years ago, it's probably better to get another dose to make sure they're protected.
So Dennis is actually sharing that we're in a community outbreak situation. That would not have been the recommendation if we did not have that going on here. We're actually taking a tiered approach to this, which I think people would appreciate. So healthcare facilities, we're encouraging all people who work or volunteer in a healthcare facility to have two doses. And then if people have a concern, they're unsure of their vaccination status, it certainly is within reason for them to get one dose. And clearly, in the group that's a little bit younger, those who are born 1957 and are after until probably 1986, we know that they are really most likely to only have one dose of vaccine. So that group, we would strongly encourage to think about getting that second dose. And then the children that were mentioned are, if they've had two doses on board, that's really where we need them to be.
The health department has sent letters to schools encouraging parents to vaccinate and warning that unvaccinated students may be asked to stay home for up to 25 days. Is there precedence for this? And what kind of reaction are you getting?
Well, yes, Franklin County and Columbus Public Health did share with superintendents a letter for them, letting them know and principals know of private and charter schools of the approach if there were a cluster in their schools. And actually, Delaware County General Health District sent this out about 10 days ago, almost 2 weeks ago, because indeed we expect that we may see some clusters in school settings. And yes, there's no doubt that there's precedent for reviewing on a case-by-case basis. Are the students in that school classroom, if that's the impacted place, to be sure that every student in that classroom is up to date with their vaccine status? Because children that are not, and certainly those who may not have been immunized at all, would be very susceptible to this. And again, we're trying to prevent the spread of this infection to others. So indeed, they could be asked to stay home for up to 25 days, as we just talked about that incubation period.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And Columbus Public Health has opened a mumps vaccine clinic. How's business?
So again, we have a fast track clinic and it's operating every day during the week, Monday through Friday. And actually business has been, I would call it slow but steady. We've seen about 136 people, I believe, over the last 2 weeks. We think that we may, and we're certainly available to see people. We are encouraging people to go to their provider, whether that's a pediatric family practitioner. We know that the nurse-managed retail outlets also have this vaccine. But again, we would be happy to see people. And I think as both the university is stepping up a campaign, we think healthcare facilities will be. I know that letters will be going out to schools, likely to daycares, that there may indeed be more interest. But again, we would first encourage people to go to their provider.
Kids aren't always the best reporters. It's not for lack of trying. It's sometimes they're just trying to explain and express something that's unfamiliar to them without the real obvious swelling as an indication. What should parents be asking their kids when they're reporting, you know, possible symptoms?
It really is jaw pain. There's okay. not a lot that will come on with this type of viral illness with
true jaw
pain.
And should they have them,
pain.
Like, move their jaw around a certain way?
No, it's just opening and closing. Some kids may complain they really don't want to eat or drink because it hurts. And as Dr. Long was saying, it's really tenderness right in front of the ear and okay. right underneath the earlobe. Because so, that's the salivary gland.
And so a kid might say, I don't want to eat, it hurts. First you say, well, is it your throat? Or is it something else that's hurting?
And in a toddler, you will probably not be able to get that out of them by history. In older kids who are in kindergarten and older, they're usually pretty good at telling you where it hurts, especially if you do the point with one finger where it hurts
right.
the most, whether
right.
it goes here at the throat or if it's more up here at the angle of the jaw.
Okay. And then are there different strains of mumps? Like there are the flu. Is there concern about vaccine-resistant mumps? Anything like that?
There are two strains of mumps that are the predominant ones that circulate. An A is an apple strain and a G is an gate strain. The fortunate part is that this strain that we use in our vaccine has good protection against both strains. So looking at the most recent scientific studies, it's not that there's a different type of mumps causing this. It's just the vaccine protection wears off.
Sharon in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sharon.
Good morning. I was wondering how insurance companies are responding to people out of the usual age cohort going for MMR.
That is a great question. And my understanding so far, we haven't heard anything to the contrary, is that insurance coverage is picking this up. So indeed, that's our expectation. Clearly, in the case of a community outbreak, this guidance that we're sharing is clearly public health guidance coming from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Ohio Department of Health, and obviously the three local public health agencies that are working on this.
Okay, Sharon, thanks for that question. We have an email. They ask, I asked my doctor if I should be vaccinated, and she said it would cost me almost $300 to see if I already have immunity. And then if not, I might not want the vaccine anyway because it was a live vaccine.
Well, I'll just
what is she talking about there?
To do a blood test to see if you're protected, that's probably at most labs more in the $100, $110 range. Now, you can do that, and certainly it'll help tell you whether or not you've had the vaccine and been protected. I am not aware of it costing that much money to get the
vaccine.
But
is it necessary? Can't you just get the vaccine? It won't hurt to get.
I think in the community, it makes a lot of sense. If you don't have a documented dose, instead of doing the blood test, just get the vaccine. Because
it's cheaper.
It probably will be cheaper. And if you're a healthcare professional, it might be another story. If a physician might need two doses of MMR rather than me get my antibody or my blood tested, mm-hmm. I just might get the two doses.
Okay. All right. Thanks for that email. Yep.
There are some people who we would encourage to talk to their physicians about getting the vaccine. Obviously, pregnant women, the issue, it is a live vaccine, so we probably would not immunize.
It's a live vaccine and there's live antibodies.
It's actually a living weakened virus.
Right.
And the most effective vaccines we have are the ones that mimic natural infection. So it's really weakened. The vaccine is not going to give someone a true case of mumps or measles.
Could you feel kind of tired or something afterwards? One of those kinds of?
You may after mm-hmm. a live vaccine. And in a way, that's good. If you're having some pain at the injection site or even fatigue 2 or 3 days later, it actually means your immune system's responding and building protection. So I take that as a good sign.
Okay. And then women who are pregnant, you're saying.
You're right. The recommendations are not to give this live vaccine to pregnant women, and actually also to consider in the case of people who are either in active chemotherapy, et cetera, who are immunocompromised. Again, that's probably a broader discussion with their physicians. But those would really be kind of the two categories of people that need to be thought through.
We only have about a minute, but if you get the mumps when you're pregnant, can it be dangerous?
There's been a few cases reported of having a stillbirth or a spontaneous abortion. The vast majority of time, it does not seem to affect the baby or fetus.
Okay. Dr. Dennis Cunningham, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Dennis Cunningham is an epidemiologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital. And Dr. Teresa Long, as always, Columbus Health Commissioner, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Have a great day.
For listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.